the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to Lightning Month on the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and to kick off my month of shows dedicated to Lightning, I've got an interview with Christian Decker from Blockstream. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So BlockFi, I have received all your questions for Zach, probably around 15 emails now with various questions. So I've collected them all up. All those questions you've got about the interest accounts, I'm going to be speaking to Zach later in the week to ask him those questions and record his answers. And I'll be publishing it on SoundCloud once we're complete. Also, yesterday, you might not have seen it, but they have completed their first payouts from the interest accounts with a total of 23.2 Bitcoin and 405.3 ETH in interest generated for BlockFi clients. So whatever your view on this, this is definitely interesting and definitely something that's worth looking into more. If you are interested in finding out more about BlockFi's interest accounts, head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. Also, I want to tell you about another cool product I discovered yesterday by a company called Rise Wallet. So for those who want to advertise on the podcast and got lower budgets, I offer a Patreon sponsorship, which gets them a little mention after my intro. Rise Wallet got in touch yesterday and sent me a voucher to test it out, and I downloaded the app and played with it, and it was so cool. It was such a great user experience. I thought, you know what, I'm just going to shove an ad on the intro for them. They deserve it for all their hard work. So they haven't paid me for this. It was just a very cool experience. So their Bitcoin gift card is definitely a cool and easy way to introduce people to Bitcoin. You basically send someone a voucher, they download the app, they scan the QR code, and the Bitcoin gets transferred to them. So I tried it out this morning. I just love the UX of the app so much. I really like how clean the design was. I've tried a few mobile apps for Bitcoin, and I've often been disappointed, but this one was so good, and I really like the way my phone shook and highlighted that I need to back up my private key. I just thought that was really cool. So yeah, really impressive stuff, Rise Wallet. If you want to check them out, head over to risewallet.com, which is risewallet.com. Okay, so let's kick off Lightning Month, a whole month of shows dedicated to Lightning. And just to prep you, the way I've approached this is I've actually tried to avoid as much information about Lightning as possible or play with it too much. I did download the Blue Wallet because I wanted to have the Lightning Torch. So I did have the Blue Wallet. I did have to transfer some Bitcoin over and play with that, but I kind of kept away from it because I've wanted to be as fresh as I can for this month with almost some of the most basic and simple ideas to introduce people to Lightning. I know there's going to be loads of experts out there, so some of this might not be for you, but I wanted to approach it as fresh as possible. So I've got my Castle Lightning node, but I haven't set it up yet. I'm going to set it up this week and have a play with it and record my notes on my experience. I mean, we're obviously early with Lightning, and my little experience so far has a mixture of excitement, but some things I don't understand or some things I want clarifying. And I don't think there was probably many better people to kick the month off with than Christian, who himself wrote a Lightning paper, Duplex Micropayment Channels, but was beaten to market. So anyway, in this interview, we talk about those competing papers. We talk about how people came together to work on a single version, but there are multiple implementations. And Christian explains what Lightning Network is, how it works, how payment channels work, and some of the exciting dev coming up. So I hope you enjoy it. I really enjoyed recording this with Christian. We did it over at MIT in Boston. So it was a few weeks back now. And listen, if you do like the show and if you want to support it, there's a section on my website that can explain everything you can do. Head over to whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section, it will explain everything to you. And if you've got any feedback on the interview, feel free to get in touch. My email is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. So I've told you about, I've got a whole month of Lightning shows coming up, and this one's going to be the first one, because when I spoke to Adam about it, he said, you have to speak to Christian. And you've heard some of my interviews, and I always start my interviews with what is Bitcoin because of the variety of answers I get. But this I'm going to be asking, obviously, something slightly different. So what is Lightning?
Lightning is a mechanism for us to make Bitcoin more useful, make it available to more people, extend Bitcoin's reach into more use cases, and basically enabling all of the promises that we thought we had solved back in 2009.
Okay, and just so everyone knows, what is your role at Blockstream?
So I'm a software engineer and researcher at Blockstream, mainly working on Lightning, the specification, and our implementation called C Lightning.
Right, okay. So Adam said to me, the reason I have to talk to you is that Taj released his white paper first, but actually you had prepared yours first, but because it was an academic paper, it was actually hidden away from everybody.
Yes.
Can you talk me through this?
So this is probably the worst thing that can happen to you as a researcher is basically that you're spending month and month on writing up a paper and coming up with a basic idea of how this should fit together and how it should work. And then you write all of this up, and in a process that takes several weeks to get it right. And then you basically send it to a conference. Sometimes you even have to wait for a conference to be opened for submissions before you can actually submit it. And then it takes, again, months on end for the conference to actually review what you've done, and then basically give you the thumbs up or thumbs down. And if you get the thumbs up, you're good to go, and you go to conference, and your paper can be published and basically makes its rounds around the world. And that's the stage where other people might jump in at the before this. Basically, only yourself and the reviewers had access to the paper. And once it's accepted and is going to a conference, you can actually share it with the wider world, because at that point you sort of had dibs on the invention. And it so happens that I wrote my duplex micropayment channels paper, which is what was under review at that time, had submitted it, and then a few days later, somebody pointed me towards this lightning.network address with a PDF on it, and I was like shocked that there is something that looks very similar to what I did. And it turns out, yes, there's a lot of overlap. We had different approaches, but they basically just had scooped me. And I spent a very frantic weekend trying to grok the paper and wrap my head around this competing proposal. And I could make out some differences, but the core idea of having a payment network made up of payment channels was the same. And yeah, that was we then had to sort of emphasize our differences a bit more and try to point out that we are better than Lightning. Yeah, at that point the race was basically lost, and the paper got published, had some success, but obviously everybody now talks about Lightning.
Right. Okay. So the community has to make a decision about which one it wants to implement.
Well, it basically is the Lightning paper coming slightly before and honestly having some major advantages over duplex micropayment channels, had more momentum behind it. And for me, it was basically the decision, do I want to create a competing implementation of a payment channel network, or do I want to join this effort surrounding Lightning and basically just help making Lightning a bigger system that has more utility than having two different systems that split the community. Because this being a payment network, I mean, the basic utility comes from everybody being on the same network, everybody being able to pay to everybody else. So I decided to drop my duplex micropayment effort in favor of joining the Lightning effort and sort of trying to get that out the door quickly, more quickly, and making it better. But we are grabbing some of the nice parts of duplex micropayment channels back, some of the good features that we had, some of the trade-offs that I liked a bit more about duplex micropayment channels, and try to bring them into Lightning. So what we end up with is sort of a synthesis of both protocols and that have better trade-offs overall.
So the people working on Lightning took a look at your paper, and you debated it together and shared ideas.
Yeah, we had some really really interesting discussions, and we saw that there are merits on both sides, and but Lightning basically had more momentum, and honestly, the trade-offs were more in favor of their side. Okay. So I decided to jump ship, and I'm in gamer terms, I'm probably a win team joiner. But it turns out that this has helped the effort quite substantially. There's no point in creating two competing networks if we can create one that where everybody can participate and everybody can interact.
So
when I spoke with you yesterday, you told me about something which I'd heard of. There is actually a long history of payment channels.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain what a payment channel is, what that actually means?
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned this usually when I give a lecture on these payment channels or layer two solutions or off-chain protocols. I'll use them interchangeably because, well, they sort of mean the same. What you basically do in a payment channel is two parties meet somewhere, they put some money on the table, and then start discussing about who gets what share of this money. The reason we put this money on the table in the first place is so that no single party can basically grab the money and run away, because, well, it needs the acknowledgement of both parties to split this money up again. Now, in Bitcoin terms, this is basically just a multi-sig address where both parties need to sign off on the payment that originates from this address, and that basically means that both of us have to come to an agreement on how we want to split this payment of how we want to split the funds that are on this multi-sig address, so that's the basic concept, and we can discuss back and forth on how to split this money. So if I put a $10 bill on the table, all 10 belong to me, and we have one transaction that basically refunds me my $10. Now, if I want to transfer $1 to you, then I create a new transaction that would be a settlement on this payment channel, and you get $1 out of this, and I get the remaining $9 out of it. And, well, we can transfer this back and forth multiple times, and we always have a transaction in our back pocket that basically reflects the latest state that we agreed upon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this might seem like a silly trick, but if you look at what the blockchain sees from all of this, is basically, okay, there is a payment that creates this multisig address where we pay in some money. That's usually called a setup transaction. And then eventually there will be a settlement transaction that sort of subsumes all of the interactions that we had in between, where we basically say, okay, this is the final state on how we want to split it. And so with these two transactions, we've just settled however many transactions we had or transfers we had between us two. And this allows us to make a far better use of the blockchain space that we have, because two transactions now basically aggregate whatever happened in millions of transfers between us two. The true power of all of this comes from the network part of Lightning Network, basically, meaning that if we have a channel open between us, it's nice to be able to move funds back and forth, but chances are that we will not have millions or billions of interactions between us, right? So the networking part is basically that I can extend a payment to you, and you can then forward it to a third party who might be the intended recipient of my initial payment. And by creating it, by chaining these multiple hops of payments along payment channels, we can actually reach anybody in the network. And that's the true power of the Lightning Network, is that by just having this two-party relationship called a channel, we can then extend payments to any participant in the network by just chaining these two-party interactions.
And you were telling me that Satoshi discussed this quite early on.
Yes. So when I give my lecture, I usually start with the question, what's the earliest payment channel or off-chain protocol that people can think of? And usually people will start talking about Lightning. Some people might mention the simple payment channels that were discussed on Bitcoin Talk quite early on, where you have where you can create incremental payments from one direction to the other, but not the reverse. But very few people actually. I've only heard core team members discuss this so far, is basically that in the original Satoshi client, there was this concept of sequence number for transactions. And that was basically that we can create an initial transaction, like our initial settlement transaction, giving me back my $10. And we can then amend this transaction by replacing it with a new transaction. And the rule would be basically be that the new transaction would need a higher sequence number than the replaced transaction. We should probably mention that that the core difficulty in all of this is that we have so we have these settlement transactions, but we have no really easy way to invalidate an old settlement transaction, right? So when we started off with the $10 on a table, and I get my we have a refund transaction that gives me back my $10, and you get $0, and then we do an update, and now you get $1 and I get $9. Now you might want to use that transaction that has $1 in it for you, and I would definitely prefer the one that gives me back my full $10, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a race between these two states. So you have a valid state that gives you $1, and I have a valid state that gives me $10. So we need a mechanism to invalidate the old state where the transaction would give me back my $10. And with the n-sequence proposal, that was basically saying, hey, if there is a transaction that has a higher sequence number, that is to be preferred to whatever came before. Now, this didn't really work. It was utterly broken. First of all, because, well, you can only replace transactions as long as they aren't confirmed. There is no real way for it to incentivize miners to actually pick only the most recent one. So they're depending on me as a miner receiving or not the updated transaction, it could happen that the old transaction would confirm and, well, we agreed to something newer, but, well, the miner didn't see whatever we agreed upon in time. We can also do it more maliciously, where I can basically go to the miner and say, hey, you know these two transactions that are competing? Please use mine, and I'll give you some small part of whatever I cheated Peter out of, right? So this bribing works. And so the in-sequence mechanism never really worked, and we ended up repurposing this field for different proposals, the check sequence verify proposal, the BIP68 relative time lock proposal, and all of that stuff. So we grabbed back the wasted space, so to speak. But we had to come up with a new update mechanism. And that's basically what all of the follow-up papers did, was basically create a system where we can enforce whatever we agreed upon and basically ensure that only the latest state actually makes it onto the chain. And I can't really use my $10 refund transaction despite having agreed with you to actually give you $1.
So that was the kind of Satoshi mentioned in it early on. At what point did it start to become, payment channels start to become a serious discussion where you guys were really thinking, this is something we now really need for Bitcoin?
So there have been quite a few experiments with payment channels along the over time. Mostly we've been using these simple micropayment channels where you can only send in one direction. That was interesting because, well, you could suddenly create a streaming mechanism, streaming service that you could pay by the second, and or what we did, or one of my students did, was basically implement an access point that you could set up a captive portal with, and then you'd basically log in and pay per byte of the that you had that you used your internet, and by the second you sort of stopped paying, you would lose internet access again. But these were inherently limited because, well, if you can only transfer in one direction, then as soon as I have used up my balance, there is no way for it to be reused again. So while we get a bit of flexibility in when we pay and how much we pay, and we can do these really rapidly adjusting, increasing payments, there is no way for us to sort of do bidirectional payments. And while there may be a way of doing multi-hop payments, they're very limited to well, all the money flows always in one direction. And so in late 2014, after I wrote a paper on Mt. Gox and malleability and all of that fun stuff, it was time for us to go back to look at scalability, which was basically my main PhD topic. And I looked at these payment channels and was like, okay, maybe we can build something out of this. And we came up with a mechanism called duplex micropayment channels that did actually allow us to do bidirectional payments, so that we kind of could actually use the money that is in a channel multiple times and send it back and forth. And yeah, as mentioned before, the Lightning effort started in parallel, and then they were able to build a different mechanism, but it ended up basically being what became the Lightning Network in the end.
Was there ever a time where you personally wrestled with the block size?
Well, very early on, when I pitched my PhD, I wrote up a document that like 16 pages and had all the problems I'd like to address on Bitcoin and how to make it work better. And basically the number one thing coming from a distributed computing background was that, yes, we have solved somehow consensus or Byzantine agreement, but it's really inefficient, and we really can't go, really can't to Visa levels of transactions. And the first publication I did was basically just going and measuring this, what happens in when broadcasting transactions in a network, and seeing what happens if you broadcast blocks and how the size of a block impacts the propagation time of the block in the network. Propagation time being the principal problem that miners face, because if you can't get your blocks to be known to the rest of the world in time, there might be a competing block. And what we showed was basically that the naturally occurring Bitcoin forks were a cause of inefficient communication in the network. And later, this was actually used by Günzira to then show that selfish mining exists, where you keeping the information for yourself might end up helping you compete against other miners. And so the first and foundational piece of research we did was basically show that, yes, there is a limit to scalability of how much a block size can grow, always with the caveat that if we want to have the network as decentralized as possible, we probably need to put some limit on the block size and not let them grow indefinitely, because then we end up with a system that never converges again to a consistent state.
Right.
And these numbers have been picked up a few times. And basically what we showed is that with the network at the time, a 13 megabyte block would basically result us not creating a chain anymore, but would basically just be a sprawling tree where everybody was on a different branch and was sort of not agreeing with anybody else on a different branch anymore.
Okay, so the let's go back to Lightning. So the paper's out, been discussed, debated back and forth. A final version, I guess, is agreed upon. And how many implementations do people start to work on? Is it two to begin with?
So it actually is quite interesting, because Taj and Joseph published the paper and suddenly there was a lot of buzz, but nobody really thought about implementing it. So at some point, Rusty, a colleague of mine, he took up the challenge of trying to write a small explainer blog post about Lightning. And when he was then hired at Blockstream, he started working on C-Lightning. In the meantime, Taj and Joseph had started looking into this more closely, and soon afterwards they founded Lightning Labs. And at the same time, a small development company in Paris called Async also thought, hey, this is cool, let's start this. So there was all of a sudden there were these three companies after months of radio silence. Suddenly there were these three companies coming up with an idea of or starting to implement these things. And at some point we decided, hey, it doesn't really make sense that we implement three different incompatible versions, maybe we should join efforts and create a more more compatible version of this and basically creating a bigger network that will help us all to get more use out of it. So to begin with, the whole effort was started with these three companies, and we met in Milan in 2016 at the Scaling Bitcoin conference, and we sort of jotted down the scope and what we'd like to do in the first version, and that's what later became the spec version 1.0, and that's what started all of this basically.
Next up, I talked to Christian more about the Lightning Network and some of the exciting things coming up. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So Kraken, my lead sponsor, they had a big announcement regarding security recently. I've talked about this a couple of times. I'm actually going to be speaking to the chief security officer at Kraken, Nick Pococo, today. I just want to find out a bit more about what they're doing so I can talk to you lot, explain to them what they're up to. But it's pretty impressive stuff. The thing that I am most excited about with Kraken in this security update is the launch of Kraken Security Labs. Their commitment to improving security across the entire cryptocurrency ecosystem, not just at Kraken. They are going to be performing vulnerability research against various third-party products. They're going to look at hardware wallets, software wallets, and any related technology, and ensuring they disclose any issues they find in a way that does not jeopardize the security of the industry. I think it's really cool. I think that commitment to working and helping the wider industry, it's always something Jesse's done. It's always something that's kind of been in him, and it just reflects what Kraken are as a company, and I'm super proud to be working them as a sponsor and really happy to be using them as my primary exchange. So if you want to read more about this, head over to their blog. It's a really interesting read. I'm probably going to be getting Nick on the podcast at some point to talk about security, especially this security labs, which is going to be looking at the wider industry. So very cool, Kraken. If you're interested in Kraken, head over to their website at kraken.com, which is kraken.com. And back to BlockFi. As I said in the intro, I've received all your questions for Zach Prince. You've got a couple more days if you want to get some in. I'm going to be recording with him at the end of the week. So if you've got a question for Zach, if you want to ask anything about their interest accounts, do drop me an email at hello@whatbitcoindid.com. I'll be putting them all to him at the end of the week. And as they announced yesterday, they've just completed their first set of payouts on their interest accounts. So whatever you think of this, whether you have doubts, it is interesting. They paid out 23.2 Bitcoin and 405.3 ETH in interest for BlockFi clients. So I can't ignore that. I've got to look at it. It's kind of interesting. I think I might even give it a go myself. If you are interested in checking out these BlockFi interest accounts, then head over to their website to find out more. It's BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com.
So is there a set of standards that you all comply with?
So we collaboratively write these documents called BOLTS, which is like the silliest acronym we could think of. It stands for Basis of Lightning Technology. Obviously, the acronym came after the name, should be, right?
Yeah.
And
it's perfect for Lightning, right?
Yeah. Come on. I think at this point we've used all of the naming jokes related to Lightning and electricity. So we collaboratively write these and sort of discuss back and forth on how we should implement certain things and how we should what the trade-offs are, and What I always like to point out is that we come from really different outlooks of into this protocol, right? There's Eclair who's primarily focused on mobile nodes that have spotty network connections and not that powerful of resources. We mostly concentrate on power users running on servers and really good connectivity. And LND basically is running mostly on desktops, which also have rather good connectivity and sort of a more hobbyist user base, so to speak.
Are there any risks of incompatibility between them?
Oh yes, we've found many of them.
Right,
but we will always come back to the table and sort of discuss trade-offs and who is right and who is wrong, and mostly we agree right away on who should change their implementation and what the right way of it is. It's mostly that we have underspec'd something, that we have an implementation detail that turns out to be to make us incompatible. So we need to add that to the spec and basically clarify where this has gone wrong and how it should be addressed in future.
Is there, or was there any discussion about just collaboratively working on one implementation?
I think no. We always had this. This idea of having multiple competing implementations, especially because, as I mentioned before, coming from different viewpoints, we're not as blind as if we were just all agreeing right away, but we can actually have this trial by fire of ideas and test them in different scenarios and test them in different implementations before settling on one solution that should be used. So I usually compare this with a dialectic principle, where you have a thesis that is proposed, it is then discussed, an antithesis is proposed, and then by combining the two, you end up with an end result that is stronger than either of the theses that started off with.
And I guess me as a user will hopefully be at a point where I won't ever know which implementation I'm using.
Yes. So that is something that we've currently started working really, really strongly on, is basically simplifying the user experience and hiding all of the nasty details of the technology behind some really nice abstractions and sort of requiring less knowledge from the user, because this should be as easy to use as possible, and you shouldn't have to learn about channels, you just shouldn't have to know about channel capacities and channel exhaustions and on-chain closures and HTLCs, what they are, how they can get stuck, and there's just so much to know in the Lightning Network, and you shouldn't have to know it to use this at all.
Okay, so it's out in the wild now, people are using it. What would you say is the current state?
Oh, the current state. Whenever I look at these plots of the current network, I'm almost overwhelmed by how quickly this thing grew. Right, it's something that it's very frightening for us. All of the people basically putting their trust in code that we wrote and all of this excitement around Lightning. And it's a really humbling exercise to see how this network grew from a few hackers that were basically just playing around with the tech to something that is being actively used and that people are actually building stuff on top.
I guess what I was asking is, where do you see it as the current state in, you know, we're still advised not to put too much money on it, not to risk too much money. Like, how far away do you think we are from having something that is you could competently say, okay, we're good now?
That's always hard. I mean, it's like having your baby, right? It will never grow up. It will always be this small, cuddly thing that you cherish and you don't want to expose it to the bad world that is out there. But at some point, you'll have to realize that this has its own life and that it has created its own world, right? And so I tend to be a bit overprotective when it comes to Lightning. I think there will not be a point that is where we can say, okay, this is now open for everybody and everybody should use it and put their life savings in it. It will be a gradual process of people and users and developers getting more comfortable with the idea of using it in their day-to-day life, and we can steer this in a way by making it easier for new users to be onboarded, but right now we're mostly focusing on people that actually can give us the technical feedback that we need to fix stuff, that can help us test the implementations, and that can later also help us onboard new people. Because if we were to open the floodgates right now, we as a developer team would be completely overwhelmed by all the support requests. So it's more about creating sort of this environment where other people can help users to onboard and to use this in the first place.
Do you still code?
I code loads, yes.
Yeah.
I've started coding in C when I started this project, and coming from a more academic background where we mostly use more abstract languages, this was really intimidating, but call it Stockholm syndrome, I'm starting to really like C. I spend like 70 to 80% of my time still coding, and the rest of the time I basically just try to help people on Stack Exchange or our issue board or whatever.
So if you had to be honest about Lightning, what are the bits that worry you and what are its potential limitations right now?
What worries me is that there might be a bit of a flashover when it comes to hype. If we get too excited and we can't deliver features quickly enough, then people might get frustrated by the lack of progress being made, despite there being progress.
Yeah.
So I always try to sort of put things into perspective and show that this is basically being built by small teams that can't move as quickly as most people would like, and so. This also plays into this slow and deliberate rollout to more people that might actually help us with this in the first place before it becomes this big thing where everybody is expecting it to work right away and it just has these small issues that are around. From a technical point of view, I think we need to improve the network structure, the resilience against failures in the network, the success rate of individual payments, and we probably need to sort of be able to bolster the capacities in the network before we can actually go to a place where we process billions of transfers a day.
It is still kind of cool though, right, isn't it, right now using it, because it pretty much works most of the time. I've used it.
Yeah.
I've had payments not go through because there hasn't been enough capacity, but a lot of the time it's been fine. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I guess you must be quite proud of that as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's an amazing feeling to see basically two screens next to each other and they connect over this global network, and you press send on one side and the green check mark on the other side appears. It's what I wanted Bitcoin to always be, and we hit against the limits there, and now we can finally get where we wanted to be in the first place. And the community feeling is huge. I mean, this feels a lot like back in 2009 when I first joined Bitcoin. It was this buzz. It was this excitement in the air about what we can do, and everybody is looking for use cases where we can apply this, and everybody's just pitching in and helping out, even if you're not a technical person, try to talk to people and what are cool ideas and what could we do, and it's all of this excitement that got me working on Bitcoin in the first place, and now we're back at that stage.
Are there any external criticisms which are fair?
I think many criticisms are fair. Okay. We should always be honest about the trade-offs that we're making with Bitcoin. One of the most prominent ones is probably that that Lightning is not well suited for huge payments. But then again, I mean, the idea of Lightning is to be a complementary system to Bitcoin, not a replacement of it. I mean, we rely on Bitcoin really heavily for our system to work. We will never replace it, right? Mm-hmm. I think criticisms are fair as long as they're not exaggerated, and we should take them seriously, and we can address them as they come up. And we always have to remember that Lightning is still a very young project. There's stuff we haven't figured out just yet, and we will cross those bridges when we come to them.
Do you have any fear about the impact of Lightning on the fee network and the worry for miners? I mean, it's a debate that's starting to happen a little bit, right?
Yeah.
And any suggestion of maybe alternative ideas? There's been talks of recycling old coins. There's been talks of having slight inflation. And everybody's shot down immediately.
Mm.
But in the back of my mind, I keep thinking, well, there could be a situation where the fee market in the future does not cover enough for the miners, and that's going to impact the security, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely a fair point and something that comes up fairly often. I do think that, look, the block space is limited and we need to keep it limited for Bitcoin to stay as decentralized as possible. So what Lightning is doing is basically making better use of the resources we have by aggregating multiple transactions into multiple transfers on the Lightning network into one or two transactions on the Bitcoin blockchain.
And it's also enabling transactions that wouldn't have happened normally as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it basically extends the reach of Bitcoin as a currency to places where that we couldn't have done before. So I almost like to call the Lightning network a fee aggregation network, because what we do is basically we create this second layer of payment channels where we now perform millions of transfers, and the work that the miners have to do is just confirm those two transactions, the setup and the settlement transaction, instead of having to verify each of these small transactions. But because we have some quite different requirements on the confirmation speed of these transactions, we are actually willing to pay higher fees for these on-chain transactions that are left on-chain. And we are willing to do so because, well, the utility we got from these two on-chain transactions is way, way higher than if we had just these two on-chain transactions without the backing off, without the aggregation that we did on the Lightning network. So I think our willingness to pay higher fees, the fact that we're a complementary network and not replacing all of the use cases for Bitcoin, will maintain the fee market such that the miners will still be able to make a living by securing the network and have less work to do to get those fees, basically.
So what are the most important things now coming up for Lightning, the key kind of development milestones?
Ooh, loads of stuff coming up.
Yeah.
So back in Milan in 2016, we sort of scoped out the specification for 1.0 such that we can basically implement this and have a minimal set of features in there as quickly as possible. Well, it turns out to have taken 2 years anyway, but okay.
Dev timelines always overrun.
Oh yeah, it's always 2 weeks.
Yeah.
but now we met in November in Adelaide for our spec 1.1 meeting and sort of scoped out what we'd like to have in there. And there's so many ideas that we basically put on the back burner to get this initial working version out. That we just put back on the table now and that we definitely like to have. And there's just so much. So for me, the most exciting ones are splicing in and splicing out. Those are basically ways for us to create on-chain transactions out of payment channels, or stocking up a payment channel by adding some funds to an existing channel. And what this basically allows us to do is to eliminate the differentiation between on-chain funds and off-chain funds. So if we have a channel among ourselves open, and I go to a merchant that accepts only on-chain payments, then what we do is basically we do a splice out where I tell you, hey, I'd like to do a splice out, and by the way, splice out $1 to this guy by providing you an address, and then we collaboratively do a close and reopen, and basically the funds are spliced out to this merchant. And what this allows us to is basically to stop differentiating between on-chain funds and off-chain funds, and you just get one big balance to see, because tends to be confusing for users to have to check, okay, I have X in off-chain funds and Y in on-chain funds, and I do want to pay Y plus one. Now I have to close a channel before I can do that. And this basically gives you one big balance that you can look at and
in your wallet
be happy about.
So you just have one balance in your wallet.
Yes.
And when you send a payment, it will just use the appropriate.
Exactly, yes.
That's cool.
And
I didn't even know about this. Because I've got that with my Blue wallet. I've got two.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very cool.
And the other feature that also goes into that same vein of user experience is multi-part payments, which allows us to bundle the capacity of multiple channels. So currently, what you have is each user needs to manage a number of channels to decide to whom they are opening it, because they are allocating funds to this. To this peer, and if this peer disappears, then this money is not available anymore, right? Or is not available for a certain timeout. So what the multi-part payment allows you to do is basically bundle multiple channels in such a way that you can do a larger payment by splitting a payment over multiple channels at the same time. And what this allows you to do is forget about the difference between having one $10 channel or 10 $1 channel, because you can always bunch them together again. So a single peer becomes less important, but you can still perform larger payments even if you split your funds over tens of channels. And what this allows us to do is basically hide channels from you, because you don't have to care anymore about having a very stable peer and having a huge capacity, because this capacity will dictate what the maximum amount you can transfer at once is, but you can basically spray a number of channels to peers that you think are okayishly reliable, in combination they will be there when you need them, right?
Okay.
And you just bundle channel capacities when you need them. And so what you end up with is basically a wallet that shows a single balance, no concept of channels if you don't want to look at them, and it's just balance and transaction list that you had before, and that looks really closely to what Bitcoin wallets are right now. So this is basically what I mean by hiding implementation details from users that don't want to put in the work to learn about these concepts, and we'll handle all of this in the background.
Oh man, that sounds so cool.
And there's so much more to come.
So much more to come. We'll have to talk again.
We have onion changes that we'd like to do, rendezvous routing, spontaneous payments, and all of that fun stuff. So
okay. So listen, if somebody's listening and they haven't had a play with Lightning yet, what would you advise them to do?
So we have a number of implementations. Each of these implementations has very good guidelines. Very good introductory guides on how to get started. All of these can be found on GitHub, and just go to to one of them. Try to figure it out. If you're more of a mobile person, if you want a mobile app, go to Eclair. They have a really good Android wallet. If you are on a desktop and just want to get started really quickly, go to LND. Download their client. It's a fully feature opinionated client that comes in as a full bundle of functionality. And if you're more of a power user that likes to tinker with stuff and you'd maybe want to create a service, then come to C-Lightning and we will guide you to where you need to be and help you where you need help.
Amazing. And how do people stay in touch with you?
I'm at Snyke, S-N-Y-K-E on Twitter. I'm C Decker on GitHub, and that's mainly it.
Great, thank you. This is really exciting. I can't wait to see these new things.
It's an awesome time to be alive.
Okay, so how was that? Did you enjoy that? Did you enjoy that as a first interview to kick off Lightning Month? I do want to say a big thank you to Christian for his patience with me. Okay, I just need to explain something. I got an eye infection in Boston. I got something in my eye, like a bit of grit. And when I was at the interview, my eye was streaming constantly. And I didn't want to cancel the interview because I wanted to do it in person. So I basically sat through the whole interview with a tissue over my eye with my face streaming, which was tough to do, but he was very patient through it all. So thank you, Christian, for that. And also, I hope you enjoyed the interview. I know this might have been basic for some of you, but I think it was great to hear about the birth of Lightning and how the teams come together and avoid things like conflicts when they're developing separate implementations. I thought that was really useful for me to hear. I also found this splicing thing interesting. I'm still trying to get my head around it. I've been reading more about it since, and it certainly appears to solve a whole bunch of UX questions I had when thinking about Lightning and moving between the base chain and the Lightning network. So yeah, that was cool. I'll probably have to do a little bit more work on that, maybe talk to somebody else about that. But I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you would like to discuss it, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And if you want to support the show, there's loads of things you can do. I'm not going to bother going through it all today. You've probably heard it 1,000 times if you listened to the show before. But basically, if you head over to my website, whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section. There's a whole bunch of stuff. Just leave reviews. You can become a patron. You can even buy some merchandise, which the profits I use to buy people Lightning nodes. So just go and check it out if you're interested in supporting the show. Outside of that, I'm going to have a whole month of interviews. Can't wait to get them to you. If you've got any feedback, got any ideas, do feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.